Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. We are here from the Hot Stove Society, as we are every week when we take this show on Tuesday mornings. If you want to join us, like this lively bunch here, waiting for breakfast. You know, they're all lively until they get their breakfast, and then they take a nap.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's the Spanish way.
Yeah, I'm Tom Douglas, owner of several of Seattle's fine restaurants, including the one we're standing above, Lola, the Carlisle Room. Congrats to Brandi Carlisle one more time for 3 Grammys. What an incredible night she had down there in L.A. And, of course, Palace Kitchen, late night at Palace Kitchen.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in the hat, owner of Luc in Madison Valley and Lule downtown Seattle.
Very
at
nice.
The corner of 6th and Union, bottom of the Sheraton.
And a new line
of fragrances. I have to mention that because I keep forgetting to mention it. We have a eau de toilette, hand soap, and a diffuser, part of a series. And the fragrance is called Lule.
You too can smell like Chef Terry anytime you want.
That's right.
Delicious. We're going to go back to basics today. Oh, Katie, you didn't tell us where you're from.
Oh, I am the marketing director over at Molly Moon's Homemade Ice Cream.
And let me just ask, you've been doing that now for what, 6 months?
A little bit longer, but yes.
How many pounds have you put on?
I actually lost some weight due to some food poisoning the other day.
Ooh, that's not good marketing for Molly Moon.
No, not for Molly Moon's. I won't name where it happened.
It wasn't one of my joints, was it?
It wasn't one of yours.
Okay.
I will say that.
Was it one of mine?
It wasn't one of yours. It was someone who's quite famous around town, okay. But I will not reveal.
All right. And you're sure it was at the restaurant, not in your home fridge?
I am.
You know,
positive.
I have a thing about
people's
home fridges.
Is there somebody more famous than Tom?
Not more famous, but definitely well known. We'll put it that way.
We're going to go back to basics about sharing some little things. And we have a young chef in our midst here. She's become quite the cook, but she was curious about a few little things. And so you asked me last week, I want to say, about caramelizing onions.
Yes. Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm the producer. And I was caramelizing onions a week or two ago, and it takes so long, or at least it did when I made them. So I wanted to go back to basics a little bit and really just go through onions in general. How do you know which ones to pick? How do you cook them? How do you cut them? All the things.
Ooh, that's coming up later in the show. In the first hour, though, we're going to discuss our favorite tastes of the week, which both Chef Terry and I had the luck of being at a delicious dinner on Saturday night, and I'm going to talk about a little bit of the food that we had there as Chef messes with my stove. And we're going to talk with Chef Bridget Charter. She's running a kids' camp. You know, she did this last year, and I thought as I walked through here one day, I said, I bet she is never doing this again.
And here she is. Doing it again. I know. I saw this segment in our little show sheet, and I thought, whew, that sounds exhausting.
Can you imagine? I mean, I can't even. I walked through one day, and I got tired. It wasn't more than 5 minutes.
Yeah, a lot of energy.
All right. And, of course, we're going to go into our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge, which I'm not sure who. I think Bridget's going to join us today.
When Bridget has the opportunity to play the trivia, she really gets her competitive spirit on.
No, she's a competitive sportsman. You know,
sailing.
Sails,
and
tennis, skiing. She teaches skiing. She's crazy.
She's a renaissance
She
woman.
And Chef Janet over here are really quite the sportswomen. Okay, let's jump into ordinary to extraordinary.
This is where you take ordinary dishes and you make them extraordinary with your know-how. The first one, Tom, I know is near and dear to your heart. I actually was thinking about this dish over the weekend. Steamed fish.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Janet, could you bring over one of the bamboo steamers? Do we have a tray over there? She's looking at me like she has no idea what I'm talking about.
Steaming is one of those arts that is very much underappreciated.
Yeah. So what I do personally is I take a wok, but you can use a maybe 2 or 3 inch tall sided pan, as long as your steamer doesn't go outside the pan, because the flame will come up around it and burn the bamboo steamer.
Right.
So I just take a wok. I pop the make a little aromatic steam in the bottom. So that's just water or with maybe a touch of sake or Chardonnay or whatever leftover dregs that you have in your fridge. Mm-hmm. It's some vermouth. A bulb of garlic, ginger, some orange peel, anything you happen to have around that's aromatic. 1 star anise pod because those things are super strong. And then I put my thin fillet of fish on a plate. I put a little butter on top, maybe a little soy sauce, a little slivers, tiny slivers of ginger or garlic, a little touch of the same wine, and then I put it into my steamer. And I steam it on the plate because I want to catch all the juices from the fish and the juices from my little add-ons. are your sauce that you're going to pour over the rice. And if you put another layer of your steamer, a lot of times those bamboo steamers come with two or three layers. Just put your bok choy up there, you know, so you have a one steam pot.
Delicious.
Delicious.
All right. The next ordinary dish, Terry, maybe you want to take this, is fennel. It's not really a dish. It's an ingredient.
So many different ways to use it. I like it raw and I like it cooked, so it's not a big challenge. I can use it any way you want, but diced really small and just simply marinated with a little rice vinegar, olive oil, salt, pepper. Makes a great base for a lot of cold dishes, appetizers, fish, raw fish, marinated fish, cured fish, all that. It's a great, I love fennel. You know, it's got a little crunchiness. It's got a little acid to it once you marinate it a little bit, so it's really delicious. And that nice, light anise flavor that finishes, I just think it reminds me so much of the south of France. Because you go in the south of France and everything has fennel or pastis in it, which is an anise liqueur. So it definitely has that reminiscing and that. But another way I like to do it is to slice it very thin and put it inside a fish. If you buy a whole fish, you put it inside a fish with a little bit of sea salt, fresh thyme, and you bake the fish whole like that. And I tell you, that fennel melts down and the whole fish has that little aroma of like fennel. I love to pop
a little lemon slice in there, too, along with that fennel and thyme. I actually have a recipe for that. I want to say in Seattle Kitchen, I think our trout has that set up in Seattle
And then
Kitchen.
Also confit, you know, you just take half, you cut them in half, and then you put them in oil, olive oil, a little bit of garlic clove, fresh thyme, bay leaf, then put that on the stove, bring it to a heat to about just below boiling point, and then put that in the oven for about 2-3 hours, and your fennel bulbs are going to gently cook.
Two or three hours at a pretty low heat.
Very low heat. 200, 220. And then just cook it for about 2-3 hours until it's totally soft. And then you have all these beautiful half bulb of fennel confit that you can use in salads. You can use as a garnish. You can puree it and make a nice little soup or sauce or whatever. I mean, it's with pureed eggplant, roasted eggplant puree and fennel.
I think that sounds quite extraordinary for what is a pretty common, humble vegetable, the fennel
bulb. It's common for cooks. You don't see a lot of home cooks using it very much, I don't think. So, and then to take Terry's one step further, you can also, when you're doing things like roasted vegetables, like carrots or parsnips or broccoli or cauliflower, put some slices of fennel in that same roast. And what you end up with, it caramelizes beautifully, and you'll end up with this really interesting flavor kind of taste to kind of offset some of the other green and whites from the cauliflower, all the things going on.
Delicious.
Okay, what to do when your favorite spot goes out of business. We're discussing how to say goodbye and how to find a new favorite place on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. You're smack dab in the middle of it from the Hot Stove Society here in downtown Seattle. You know, last week I alluded, or a while ago, I alluded toward the sadness of that you feel sometimes when your favorite restaurant goes out of business. And I'm not just saying this as a restaurateur, because they're my hobby. They're my passion in or out of my own restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
I go to restaurants all over the world. I look forward to it. I plan on the ones I want to get to.
It's our great joy. It's actually part of the reason why I think all of us probably choose where we go to travel is purely based on some restaurants or some cuisines that we're just really wanting to try.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure Vietnam is beautiful, but I'd rather eat the food.
Exactly. I'm just looking for that good boon, you know? Good
fun. I'm with you. I went to Vietnam. It was beautiful, but man, the food was delicious.
Yeah.
Yesterday, I went out for lunch with my wife, a Monday date lunch, and we went to Sup.
The Sup shop
down in the ID. And, you know, it's just, I don't know what I'd do if Fabak just wasn't there when I wanted it to be there, right?
You
know, so.
And it's been there for a very long time, and I love that the next generation is taking it over.
I went the day that it was snowing, I actually went there and they were closed, and I was like, what? I didn't know they closed.
Yeah, exactly. So my place that I miss, and I, you know, one goes way back, right? When Jackie and I were dating 37, 38 years ago, we used to date at Labuznik, which was down on First Avenue. It's right across from the Virginia Inn, that space down there. And it was just our place. It was very uptown, actually somewhat expensive in the back dining room. In the front, they had the cafe menu, which is where we sat. And I had the roast pork, and she had the roast duck. and we had the little sauerkraut soup, and then, you know, all the little things. But every time we went, we knew what we were having before we walked in the front door. And then when Peter decided to retire, Peter and Susan, who own Lubusnik, you know, they had their typical kind of going out. I think it was 6 weeks or something like that. And then the last, if I remember right, the last New Year's Eve was the last dinner. And we went for that. And it was super fun. And I miss it to this day. But the one that just happened to me was Vera's in Ballard, which is where I took my daughter on little a daddy-daughter breakfasts many, many, many times over her 29 years. And we heard it was closing months and months ago, so we went a few times to kind of say goodbye. But it actually did close the beginning of December.
But I think part of what you're saying with both Lubusnik and Vera's in this particular case is that you have a lot of personal memories in these restaurants. They become extensions of even your home sometimes when you don't have the time to cook, or your new parents, or, you know, the multitude of things that get in the way of you making dinner at home, or because you have a special occasion. And so when those restaurants go away, it's really sad.
Yeah, and if you look at the two different ones, Lubusnik and Vera's, I mean, Lubusnik has been gone for 15, 20 years, and I still have those thoughts about it, right? I wrote a chapter in my book about it. But two very different, one super highly esteemed, known for its food, known for its famous creator, blah, blah, blah. And Vera's, just your classic neighborhood joint, right? So it isn't about stars. It's all about that human connection that you make over the multiple times that you went. Do you have any favorites like that?
Oh, my gosh. I still mourn the loss of Sea Garden in the International District.
Oh, yeah.
When my family first moved from California into Washington, it was like the big hunt for good Chinese food. You know, there's just a plethora in Southern California. So coming up here, it was like, oh, where'd we find it? Went to the International District, and Sea Garden was the place where we had all of our big family dinners. We ordered so much food when we would go there that the servers would often say, you know, this is a lot of food. And we'd be like, yes, we know we're ordering a lot of food. But, you know, five very tiny Japanese people at the Lazy Susan getting just everything, all the seafood and the black beans and the clams and the hot pots. And that is one restaurant that I still miss to this day. They unfortunately suffered a fire in that building, and I walked past it not that long ago. It's still vacant. And
well, it's under construction now, at least.
Is it lease?
No, at least.
At least?
It had insurance issues for quite a few years, but now it's under construction and not far from being finished. Now, whether Sea Garden is going back in or not, I have no idea.
That would be my dream come true. I would really welcome that, but you have no expectations at this point because it's been gone for such a long time.
That's true.
Yeah.
Right around the corner there is Tai Tung, so I happen, that's where I hang out at the counter, right? So I happen to keep track of where the Sea Garden building is going.
Very nice. I've had some nice, very memorable dinners at Tai Tung as well. Another great spot.
Terry, any restaurant that you were super big fan of?
I think there's a location in Madison Park at the end of Madison there when you make a left. Completely at the end you make a left. There's there used to be Dominic Place.
Exactly.
And that was, when he left, I was like, damn, there's no, you know, that's going to be hard. And then Sustenza came in, Sustenza, and that was very delicious as well. And it was very much a nice little neighborhood restaurant. And then Madison Park Conservatory, because they went out eventually, you know, I don't know, like 7, 8, 10 years. They went out, and then Madison Park Conservatory came in, and then
they went out of business.
And then they went out, and then now it's Park Place. And, you know, I'm just like, it's changed. I mean, I've been in that area or not close to it for 31 years, and it's changed like hands 5 times. That's a lot.
What do you suppose it is? I mean, I get calls from friends in Madison Park, why don't you open a restaurant down there? Blah, 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 blah. And then I can just show them the places. Like that particular location is out of business, out of business. Even the old Madison Park restaurant was across the street in a house there. It was 4 or 5 different things out of business. You know, what people ask me that. Why do these places just keep coming and going? There's something about that particular restaurant. And you think that's a very wealthy neighborhood. You'd think they could support a restaurant like that.
The same is true with the Loveless building. They have a spot in the Loveless building up on Roy that has turned over quite a few times. It's a really cute space. Mm-hmm. But even since I've been aware of it, it's had quite a few
times. The one next to Kobe at Higo? Kobe?
Correct.
The gift shop?
There's like Kobe, and then there's Joe Bar, which seems to do well. And then there's that restaurant space. Hopefully, who's in there now is going to remain successful. But I've seen
that's the old Russian restaurant, the Byzantine used to be.
Yeah, it used to be the Byzantine, and then it was Olivar and
good job.
A lot of different restaurants.
Interesting.
Yeah, restaurants are very much part of our life. You know, especially if it's a neighborhood restaurant, I think it's very much part of your life every day. And then when they go, you go. And at the same, I'm sure in Madison Park, people are still talking about how they're missing those restaurants.
Uh-huh.
But they don't supply them enough.
Or
support them enough. Yeah. That's what I mean. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they don't support them enough. So, you know, you have to support your own restaurant than you like. So it's important.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the Sea Garden space. You know, mm-hmm. Ocean Star is the closest thing to Sea Garden.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't have the soul. I mean, I've eaten there a few times. The food's fine, blah, blah, blah. I had a most delicious king crab out of the tank there, which you don't see very often, live king crab.
Mm-hmm.
But it just doesn't have the same soul.
Yeah. And, you know, I've actually, now that I think about it, you and I have had some meals at Sea Garden as well. I want to say Loretta, just having celebrated her birthday, had a birthday party at Sea Garden with a big cake and, you know, again, all the tables with the Lazy Susans. There was something about being there that, again, felt very much like an extension of your home. It was very comfortable.
Well, here's what I'll tell you, Katie.
Hmm.
Since you live, your family, you grew up in Issaquah.
Mm-hmm.
You don't live over there anymore.
No.
Maybe this isn't important then, but there is a delicious Chinese restaurant in Bellevue that has a whole crab on the menu, whole Peking duck on the menu.
What's the name of it?
Peony. Chef Dana, Danna, is the chef there, and it's on Old Main.
I'm willing to go.
It's a beautiful, kind of modern looking restaurant in a brand new building, mm-hmm. obviously, and it's super large. I think they're ruining the day they decided to make a 250-seat restaurant.
That's a big spot on Main.
Yeah, it is huge. But it is delicious, and she's a terrific cook and never seems to let well enough be. She's mm-hmm. always trying to make it better.
So, all right.
I would make a special trip to Bellevue just for that restaurant.
Mm.
All right, so I'm looking forward to making new favorite restaurants, that's for sure. Up next, we're going to talk about onions, a plain and simple little onion. And how to buy them, how to slice them, and then how to make caramelized onions, which are the basis of
and
so many
burn them too.
And how to burn them. Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O.
Katie O, what do you see in front of you, Katie O?
Ooh, I see something that definitely looks very familiar and might just be the basic building blocks of a million dishes.
A million things. What's your favorite thing with caramelized onions?
You know, it's hard to beat a really delicious burger with caramelized onions on it. I feel like they really shine and bring out the meatiness in that patty. What are you doing there, Tom?
Listen.
The sweet symphony of onions.
That's what I'm doing. That is a symphony right there. That is fantastic.
I just wish they could smell it.
I know. Chef's got the fire up. So, Sarah, tell us about your quest for the perfect caramelized onions, and why do you feel the need that this is too fast for you? This is part of cooking. This is the essence.
Yeah. I mean, I do feel like it's just a skill that... I don't actually see a lot, like, at home.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't remember my parents caramelizing a lot of onions. I definitely don't see my friends doing it, but they're delicious, and they're amazing. And they seem like, you know, onions are such a basic food.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're one of the first things that you learn to just throw into dishes to make them taste good. So it seems like a skill that you should have, and you should just be able to whip out and, you know, throw some caramelized onions into a soup or to whatever you want.
I'm 100% with you. I always talk about... You know, when we talk what's left in your fridge or whatever, I always talk about that half onion you put in the fridge one day, 2 day, 3 day. Every time you open the fridge, you look at that onion, and every time you open the fridge, the onion opens up, like, come on, use me. And then you finally feel like you have the right to put in the garbage. It's so simple. Just take the onion, slice it, throw it in the pan while you're doing something else, and then caramelize it.
I feel like
caramelized it. Once it's caramelized, it's the sweetest, most beautiful product you can use in so many different ways. On sandwiches, on grilled bread, on so many different items. It's so crazy how people don't know how to do this. And it is such a good basics to have, because you just revived and made a new life to this onion that you've been looking at going, I can one more day and I can throw it away.
I feel like caramelizing onions is almost intimidating to a lot of people because it involves leaving the onions, like just leaving them on the stove for a period of time. And I, at least, am always worried that you're going to burn them.
You are very right. People are very nervous in front of the pan.
Well, the other part of that is, too, is that we've all been taught from a pretty young age, like, the worst thing that you could do when making dinner, particularly for guests, is burning something. I mean, there's so many sitcoms where someone's pulling something out of the oven that's been overcooked or the steak is overcooked. And so there's something about this that I'm sure is a little bit like, am I pushing it too far?
Yeah, exactly. So the trick about that, so let's start from the beginning. Let's buy good onions to start with, right?
Right.
So, Chef, in front of you, if you can't see this, which most of you can't, but feel free to go on our Facebook. We're taking some pictures as we go along here. But you want to reach for your yellow onions in the grocery store, and I don't mind just buying the cheap old Washington yellow onion.
Me neither.
Go buy the sweet onions, all that kind of thing. That's all great, but we're going to reduce. We're going to reduce them down to their sugar level anyway. And so, what I have here in my hands are two yellow onions, and the audience here can see one looks in pretty bad shape. This is out of the same bag that was delivered to us this morning.
It's looking shabby.
One looks really shabby. You can see it's a little bit translucent on the outside. Mm-hmm. It's been beaten up. It looks like it got a little wet. And then the other one is shiny yellow, really firm to the touch. That's exactly what I want. Now, let's face it. These onions have been in cold storage. These were picked probably in September, is my guess.
Maybe earlier than that.
Maybe August, September. So they've been in cold storage for 6 months now. And this onion is in beautiful shape. You can see one weight mark. And by the weight mark, I mean these things are stacked tons on top of tons on top of tons.
Right, it has a little flat
it's
side.
It's not a bad mark. It's just where the weight was sitting against that onion. Because they're round, right? They touch in certain spots. So this other one, I would never buy. Matter of fact, this will just get culled out of our 50-pound sack and get thrown away. We could cut it open and see if it's even worth using for stock.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The other one, it's nice and firm, but it's got watermarks on it where you can see this onion was wet before, and that's what stains. You know, that brown skin is very much a coloring agent, right?
Yeah,
it doesn't really taste anything.
It's a very clean, dry product.
Yeah, but you can really tell how the onion's been handled or where it's been sitting by the watermarks, and it looks very much like a watercolor mark on there. So. And then you just want to cut them in half, take a peel off. And when I'm doing this kind of caramelized onion, I want to take one layer down because the dryish outside edge of the onion might work in some instances, but it gets kind of weird in here. Chef, you have that pan up a little hot.
Well, I just wanted to caramelize it. Really
You're
well.
Trying to get there really fast.
We have a show.
He's rushing the process.
Okay. So what other questions do you have about picking an onion? Anything?
Well, there are so many different types of onions. Mm-hmm. Like, I realize for caramelizing onions, you can just use a regular yellow onion. But for just a regular dish, like, say, you're making soup, it doesn't matter what kind of onion you get, a sweet versus a yellow versus a white.
It doesn't matter, but these are 79 cents a pound, and a sweet onion is $1.79 a pound.
Fair.
So it's kind of up to you. What really matters is how delicious your stock is going in on top of that and how dark you get them, right, Chef?
The longer you're going to cook something, the lower denominator is the best. Only because it's a waste to use the Walla Walla sweet, for example. Now, if you're going to make a salad with raw onion, or you're just going to do a quick saute of onion with, a piece of fish or something.
Or grilled on the grill, I think.
You want to use the top product you can find. But onions at their base is a very good vegetable to use. And it's such an enhancer of flavor. I think it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's full of water, full of sugar. It's like, how much better can life be?
Right. And to get back to your point about walking away from your stove, if you do them on low, if you have an hour or hour and a half, go ahead and put it on low. Then you can walk away. You can go do laundry. You can do anything you want while your onions are cooking. If you're trying to rush them, you're just home from work and you really want onion soup, but you have to kind of rush them, then you have to tend them at the stove. And keep going. Chef, these are, I would say, the color of the skin of an onion right now.
Correct.
Is that where you're going to stop?
I want to go a little bit further.
You want to go further.
Yeah.
So let's turn that pan back on, and we'll revisit those maybe in the next segment.
Let's talk about cutting onions, because there's a lot of ways depending on how you're going to use it. Like, say, if you're going to do a quick stir fry, maybe you would cut the slices pole to pole. In this particular case, when you're making caramelized mm-hmm. onions, what is your preferred slice method?
You're cooking them all the way down. It really makes no
difference.
Doesn't matter. Because the structure is gone,
mm-hmm.
right? They're going to be mush. And matter of fact, you've heard me talk about my gravy at Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah.
This is where I want my onions even darker than this. They're sitting under my turkey. They've been roasting for a couple hours.
They're soft, soft,
and
soft.
And they're going to disintegrate. Mm-hmm. I put my hand blender, and they're going to disintegrate into my gravy. That's the thickener, is
right.
that
right.
onion paste, right?
Right.
So that, to me, is...
And also, this is when you use a thick bottom pan, cast iron or stainless steel. And then the easiest way in the world to clean that pan, because most people are afraid of heat and they're afraid of getting their pan dirty, which is kind of amazing, but that's just what it is.
There's products
So this pan looks like... I mean, this pan, if you look at it, you go, oh, my God, he destroyed that pan. You take the onions out of there, you keep the pan hot, you get the onions out of there, you put some water into the pan, you take a spatula and you deglaze the whole pan, and it's clean.
And that's flavor you want to add to your soup, to your stock, right?
Mm-hmm.
That what
Absolutely.
Burnt onto the pan here, that's not always the case, right? But in this
right.
scenario, that's the whey from the butter and the sugars from the onions that have kind of burnt or caramelized themselves onto the pan.
I would say that to a certain extent, in my experience, and maybe you guys feel differently about this, when you're making caramelized onions, the pan does matter to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
So using, say, a nonstick, for example, is not going to give you that fawn from the onions that you're going to be able to deglaze.
Correct.
No, well, it doesn't stay on the pan, but it then just stays on the onion. It doesn't change.
Mm-hmm.
The brown is still the brown. It's just that you don't have to deglaze the pan like you do with a stainless steel pan like we have here, right?
Yeah, but because you're also doing high heat and long heat, I would recommend staying away from a nonstick.
Right.
Yeah.
That would be my first advice.
Yeah. Although, Chef, I mean, the real deal is you're not supposed to take nonstick above 400 degrees, right?
Right. Which
so
is,
if you're doing a low and slow caramelized onion, it might be the perfect pan use for that, other than like a over easy egg.
See, this is why it's great to talk about.
Well, I'm just saying that's the thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You gotta
think
about your
It depends on how much heat you're using. If you're using high heat, stay away from the nonstick.
So what else would you do with that onion? So Chef Terry makes the best onion soup in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do with those onions?
That's a good question. I think my first thought is actually, this might not be what you'd normally do with them. I've been really wanting to make like a good baked potato recently,
uh-huh.
like piled high with all the different kinds of things
yeah.
that you can put on top. And some caramelized onions on top of a good baked potato just sound absolutely delicious to me.
Perfect. You made a dish for us one time here that would lend itself to these beautiful caramelized onions. Do you remember what that was?
Was it shakshuka?
Shakshuka, yeah. That's the perfect
yes.
place.
Mm-hmm.
With then you, like here, you would start with this and then add your tomato sauce to it, right? And then now you've got this incredibly caramelized, delicious tomato base for your eggs.
In shakshuka, they just have a tendency to be crunchy onions.
Right.
Instead, you put caramelized onion, and now you get the sweetness that's going to counter the tomato acids. It's going to be delicious.
It's going to change everything. It's going to change your game.
It's going to change your game. You're going to be the best one now.
Mm-hmm. Time to go back to making some shakshuka then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Tom, what would you use this caramelized
Well, you know,
onion
something
for?
Like this, I would now, at this stage where they're nice and brown and caramelized, I would add maybe a sliced crimini mushroom that's been the same thing to that,
mm-hmm.
and I'd make a little relish to go on top of a mustard glazed pork chop.
Yeah. Mm.
So just like a little condiment of caramelized onions and mushrooms on top of a nicely grilled pork chop. So, there, I mean, all sorts of ways to utilize. That's why they're so versatile
Endless,
and so
really.
Delicious. And
mm-hmm.
they smell so good. Up next,
Loosebrink.
Avril Dunn and Chantel Loosebrink of Taste Washington are here to give us the deets on our favorite food event of the year. Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen from the Hot Stove Society. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rotero, the chef in a hat.
And I'm Katie O.
It's time for the Taste Washington annual event here at the CenturyLink Event Center down there. Is that the name of it now? I can never. Is it Safeco now or is it not? What is it now?
Definitely CenturyLink Field Event Center.
CenturyLink
yeah.
Field
Rolls
Event
right
Center,
off
right down
Rolls
by the stadium.
Right
we have Avril Dunn and Chantel Loosebrink here from Taste Washington. And you're gearing up. Let's just get the deets out of the way as soon as we can. Let's tell people about the tickets and the prices and when it is and all that sort of thing.
Well, I think first and foremost, it's a four-day Epicurean festival this year. This is the 22nd annual Taste Washington. We're very excited. There's a lot of things that are new, and I think first and foremost would be tastewashington.org is going to have all of the information on every event with every possible ticket price and the times. So that would be the best place to find your good information.
And the countdown is on.
Does that include my event?
That does include your event, Tom Douglas.
You know what my event is?
The Sunday Brunch.
That's right.
Which we're so excited about because that is the home opening weekend with the Mariners against the Boston Red Sox. Mm-hmm. And you and Chef Anna have an incredible bi-coastal menu I've been hearing rumors about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Anna Sartoon, who I hired at Cafe Sport like a million years ago, moved to Boston and has become a well-known chef and she married a farmer, and she's like living the restaurant dream back there at Oleana and can't remember the other name of her restaurants. But beautiful book, Spice, is her book, and she has a brand new one out that I haven't actually read through yet. But yeah, we're going to do a brunch. Super fun.
What a fun reunion.
The good news is, sold out.
Yeah. But the other good news
is, brunch.
Yeah,
just
not everything is sold out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but not everything's sold out.
The countdown is on because the first event kicks off on Thursday, March 28th. And it runs all the way, events run all the way through Sunday, March 31st.
And there's a spectacular amount of things to do every day. So do you want us to cover off on some highlights of new things?
Let's talk about what I just found out. KDO, do you want to tell us what you're doing at Taste Washington?
Well, I am emceeing the chef stage this year. So I'm super excited about that. The lineup looks fantastic. And I was approached by the organizers, and I thought, heck yeah, I love Taste Washington. It is pretty much like a holiday weekend, as these fine ladies are explaining. It's multiple days. Good time to put in some PTO requests, I would say, and then just really enjoy your own city and state like you're a tourist, frankly.
Have you seen the lineup of Chef? Do you know who's coming?
Yes. Well, there's Eduardo, local favorite, Gregory Gourdet, lots of awesome chefs. But as they're saying, Taste Washington is where you're going to go on the old internets.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and here's a fun fact to go on that, Kate. There is actually 6 of the 2019 James Beard nominees will be in some fashion at Taste Washington this year, which is really exciting because you really can dive into what's coming up on the culinary scene here in Washington. But also there's a vineyard. Mike Sauer and Red Willow Vineyards will also were nominated for a James Beard and will be at Taste Washington as well. So there's a lot to explore.
Isn't that awesome? You know, I met our marketing director, Madeline Dow. I met her when she was 2 years old on an ATV in Mike Sauer's vineyard, Red Willow Vineyard, with her pops. Isn't that now she must be 80. You know, she's totally up there in years now.
Yeah. Not even here to not even defend.
So Red Willow, I mean, that's a very famous vineyard for people that started Washington growing grapes here, right? Because it's also one of the first vineyards that planted outside of Cabernet and Riesling. I was there checking on Nebbiolo grapes with Madeline's father, who had an Italian restaurant here, Peter Dow. And so he's always been kind of an experimental grape grower.
And I love his Sangiovese.
Yeah, exactly. See what I mean? Sangiovese right there. What do you like about it? Why is it in particular just... Because, you know, Sangiovese is the grape of Chianti. And do we know what makes it different here in Washington other than obviously the terroir and that sort of thing?
No, I mean, you nailed it, terroir. Yeah, uh-huh. You said other than it was almost an after fact, but that's a huge factor of it.
It is the factor,
yeah.
I guess. Yeah,
well, and what's fun about Washington State's terroir is that it allows us to produce over 70 different grape varietals in just our tiny little Washington State.
And is that good?
That's great.
Is it?
It's great. Especially nowadays. I mean, education is going up. Curiosity is going up. Wineries are growing. Grape growers are expanding. So we're just doing nothing but more and better, and it's just producing a lot of really amazing wines.
And other than being like a very fun weekend, I mean, that is kind of what Taste Washington is all about, right? It's highlighting what's going on in the wine and food industry and really educating a lot of us, because there is so much going on that you do kind of have to keep up on it in this way that is kind of difficult, other than to go to one of these big events and really taste and try
all the different wine from around the region and really get a sense of, you know, your favorite wine.
Well, and variety is the spice of life, no? So what you may have liked last year, you could find a totally different varietal that's doing great this year, or a different restaurant, or a new chef that's creating something totally cool. So. Mm-hmm.
And what's great about the Taste Washington format is that across the 4 days, there are really every different style of format to get involved and to get educated and to experience that.
So when you say that, do you mean, like, is there a sparkling wine section or, like, what are you saying format-wise?
Well, so Thursday, that very first day of the festival, it's the red and white party at Aqua by El Gaucho. And that's a bit more of our elegant, fancy, you get to peek into the winemaker's cellars from their wine selection. You have bites from the chef at Aqua by El Gaucho. You wear your best red and white, so you have a little bit more of that formal, fancy approach to the wine world.
So the big numbers.
That's right.
Yeah.
But then the next morning, for example, Taste Washington on the Farm, you're familiar with being involved in this in the past, you literally get out into a farm, you get your boots dirty, you walk around with the farmer, you sit at a table with the winemakers and drink their wine, and then you eat food prepared by a chef right there on the farm. So a little bit more rugged, a little bit more laid back, a little bit more real, if you will.
Right.
And then,
what a great chance to peek behind the curtain and see where your food's coming from, too. I mean, that's incredible.
I don't know about these grapes vineyards, but our farm is still under 20 inches of snow.
So much snow.
Yeah.
I mean, even here in Seattle, we saw it. But yes, Eastern Washington is definitely still very much in snow. But from a grape perspective, we're not at all worried. Grapes actually go dormant in the winter, so all of our little vines are just sleeping right now, and things are cool.
Isn't it amazing?
We're cool.
Because sometimes we have buds at this point.
That's right.
And other times, like right now, they are still dormant, and hopefully that snow is kicking butt on some sage rats out there because they like our crops a little too much. So anything that's not missed, we have about 30 seconds left, anything that you would not miss if you're spending your 4 days at Taste Washington?
Oh, man, there's some really cool new events this year. I think the Lexus Late Night and the new Vintage is one not to miss. That's going to be a really cool Epicurean journey at the Sanctuary, which is open to this event. And that's going to be a really neat way to kind of intertwine wine, food, cocktails all at the same time. And for the first time, we have a late night event, so your party doesn't have to stop.
As long as you got an Uber or a Lyft, everything
Absolutely.
Can go forward.
That's right.
What, tell us the info one more time, how to get tickets.
TasteWashington.org.
Pretty simple.
Yeah, and we're actually going to be giving away some tickets to this.
Oh, during
our Tasty Trivia Challenge.
Nice. So, if you want to meet KDO and check out the chef stage, you can go to Taste Washington or come here, buy a $15 ticket here and come to the radio show. You know, word is on the street, the radio show has become a tough ticket.
Really?
Yeah, that's the word on the street.
We're,
we're finally popular.
Yeah.
Finally. Thanks for that, KDO. Finally popular.
We should raise it to $16.
Yeah. Up next is the Taste of the Week on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. Everyone's so excited. You too can be excited if you want to come to the Hot Kitchen or the Hot Stove Society and watch the show on Tuesday mornings from 9 to 11. Just go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets. $15 comes with a delicious breakfast sandwich. You'll have to take my word for it, you all, until they get here. They're going to be hot and tasty and all the fresh coffee you can drink.
Yeah, free entertainment essentially at that point.
Are you considering yourself the talent right now, free entertainment?
I was considering all three of us.
I see the ring on your finger. You're not free.
I'm not free.
You're expensive.
Yeah, that's right. It's true.
That's right.
Nothing's
Most importantly,
free.
She's not for sale.
Okay, we're going to check in on our onions. Sarah, what did you see? What are you seeing? Are you? We're an hour into this process, and we've had the onions on low, medium, high, and now back on kind of medium low.
Yeah, they're a lot browner than, for some reason, I had thought caramelized onions were. They're also a lot, I guess, mushier is the word.
Uh-huh.
Which,
softer.
And they smell delicious.
So, at this point, Chef, you're taking these onions more towards a soup range. Like, if I was doing what I said about my pork chops, I probably would have pulled them at that time because I want them to have a little bit of bite left.
This is fine. Right now, it's fine. You can pull them off.
But now you can start to use these for, like I said, gravy, you know, where they'll disintegrate into your sauce or into your soup, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when you make a gravy with onions like this, all you do is put some water or some red wine or some white wine, reduce that down, and then you can put that in a blender and mix it you know, puree it down, and then it will be a thick sauce. You don't need to put flour. Right. You don't need to add anything like that.
So we're going to visit these when Chef feels like they're done. He thinks another 10 minutes, which puts them at about an hour and 15 minutes on the stove. We'll revisit those, and we're posting photos on our Facebook page. Because apparently we don't have an Instagram.
Well, we'll be posting a timeline. So throughout the morning, we've been taking pictures so you can see what they've looked like at different times throughout this hour. And
I would say we're getting closer to mahogany right now.
Yes, I would say
when
so.
You're looking
nice
at
mahogany
that.
Color.
Because before we were kind of at the yellow onion skin, right, or the brown onion skin.
We were at the blonde stage before. Now we're like at the
darker
stage.
Let's get into our taste of the week. KDO.
Whew! I have been told by my friend Callie Meyer and another friend Greg Flores to go to Fuji Bakery and try a very specific item there for months. And I just, for whatever reason, I go to Uwajimaya and then just didn't stop at the bakery. Finally made my way there in the International District and got a curry beef bun.
Mm-hmm.
It was delicious.
Nice.
And my taste of the week. It was coated before it was fried, I want to say, and maybe panko breadcrumbs, so it was extra crispy on the outside of this bun.
Mm.
And it was more of a donut-like texture. And then it was filled with a shredded curried beef. And the women that work there are so sweet. They're like, take this home, heat it up for like 30 seconds, and it'll be perfect. And it was. It was a real savory treat, I will tell you that. And highly recommend that bakery. A lot of good stuff coming out of it.
30 seconds of oven or microwave?
Microwave.
So you want it pretty hot. Then.
Yeah, you want it pretty hot.
And is that the same bakery that's down on Elliott?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the home bakery, and then they distribute through. Okay, good. Chef, how about you?
Well, it was that blood sausage we had at Amandino the other night. Amandino and Marilyn, who did a dinner. They were hosting a dinner that Tom graciously bought at the auction of Savor, the Food Lifeline auction dinner every year at Cedarbrook Lodge.
Yeah.
And one of the table that was ready when we got there was those little kind of antipasto / appetizer. There was ham. Prosciutto, and there was it's a beautiful cheese, delicious age. What was it? An Asiago? No, what was it?
No, it was a 30-month Reggiano Parmesan.
Reggiano.
Yeah,
and there was that blood sausage that Amandino made, which I haven't had a blood sausage that good since I left France, I think.
Now I was curious about that sausage because it tasted cured rather than cooked. Is that true?
No, or it's poached.
It was poached.
Oh yeah, it has to be. It would be poached, yeah. But it's cured. I mean, it's got... And it was also a little bit sweeter than I'm used to.
Mm-hmm.
It probably put a little sugar in there or something sweet.
So a blood sausage like that, you've got the ground pork.
Uh-huh. And the ground
big,
fat.
A big thick grind, though, right? A big, heavy grind, not a fine grind.
Correct.
Grind. Same with the fat.
Yeah.
And are you just putting, like, cubes of fat in it, or are you grinding
you
the fat?
You put little tiny cubes of... fat. And then you put the blood, and you put the whole thing. It's made into a stew, and you put it in the casing, and then you poach it, and then you have what's called boudin noir, which is what we do it in France. And then what I like to do is, he was serving it cold, but what I like to do is to put it in a pan with a little butter, obviously, and then cook it slowly, just like a sausage. You know, you cook it very slowly and in a pan until it's beautifully caramelized on the outside, and you have this warm boudin noir with mashed potato. It's like... I know, it's an acquired taste, but man, I grew up with this stuff, and it's delicious.
Yeah.
I think it's an acquired taste if you are not...
Thinking about it.
Like if you didn't know what was in front of you, this is kind of one of those classic, like if you didn't know that was...
Yeah, it's not what you think.
It's
right?
not what you think.
You think blood sausage that freaks people out.
Yeah, it seems like it would be irony and kind of livery, but it's not
actually
at all.
Delicious.
It's very, very delicious.
So if you don't know what it is, you would think it's just another salami of some sort or sausage of some sort.
Precisely.
For me, what I enjoyed about our dinner at Armandino and Marilyn's house was... Marilyn has, you know, started Salumi down in Pioneer Square years ago, right? And she used to do these big dinners. I think you could book them. They were booked out a year or two in advance, kind of like our radio show. Maybe not.
Everyone gave us a pity laugh for that.
Play a pity laugh
so
there. Yeah.
Your tickets.
Yeah. But and they were really famous, not just for the nose-to-tail aspect that Armandino would do, but Marilyn's gnocchi. And she just loves making it. Yeah. And it's just a baked potato gnocchi.
Fantastic.
They were really fun and delicious. And
light.
And, you know, what I loved what she did that dinner. And people should do this when they're thinking about their dinner parties. And I've done this myself because I've learned it from Marilyn and those folks. But plan a dish that maybe takes some audience participation. And that, to me, is what makes a dinner party feel interactive and fun. Mm-hmm. And you're always wondering, what can I do, blah, blah, blah. But so she left the big gnocchi dough pile right there in her kitchen, had boards for each of us to help her make the gnocchi with. And it was just about kind of forming them. And it was such a fun activity with somebody I super admire, you know, and then we got to sit down and eat them a few minutes later, yeah. And it was really fun. And I really suggest that. I think that's a fun
it's
way
a
to
great
throw
idea,
a party.
For sure.
I yeah. also think that's where some of the best conversation happens,
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
is in the kitchen cooking together.
Yeah, if you've seen Crazy Rich Asians, right? Mm-hmm. The dumpling scene where they kind of gather as a family to make the dumplings, and then they all eat them a little bit later,
yeah.
and they're fantastic, and
yeah.
you feel part of it, and all that sort of thing. So don't forget to include your guest in dinner. Up next, it's a dinner again for a leprechaun at Katie's house.
That's
on
right.
On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's time for a dinner party celebrating March 17th and the leprechaun. St. Patrick's Day and the leprechaun.
Yes, yeah. That is right. We are having a dinner party at my place, and the theme this time around is going to be Irish foods. A lot of people love celebrating St. Patty's Day. And Tom, a couple years back, you taught me how to make my corned beef.
And?
It was delicious. I loved your version.
What was the hardest part of making corned beef, Katie?
Just going and making sure you got your piece of brisket,
Market House,
basically.
Brisket.
Yeah, that's yeah. it. That was the biggest part was finding parking and going in and purchasing it. But other than that, it's a pretty simple process.
I think it's pretty simple, but you have to have patience.
Yes, and
right?
I asked a lot of questions uh-huh. of you along the way because I was feeling insecure because I had never done it before. And so maybe there are some listeners out there right now that want to revise the way that they've done it before or are looking to do it for the first time. But Tom, as you know, Thierry, we like to invite a guest, and Sarah's favorite Irishman, Sarah, our producer, loves Bono. Did you know that? She's a big U2 fan.
I love Bono.
Oh, I love Bono, too.
Okay,
it's
well,
be
apparently
fun. Sarah,
apparently
why
all
are you all blushing and everything? It's okay to love Bono.
You know, my first thought had been Yvonne Lind. She plays Luna Lovegood in the Harry Potter movies,
uh-huh.
but I figured Bono was a more well-known celebrity.
What about Saoirse Ronan?
That's right. She is Irish. Let's invite
Irish.
All of them. Every Irish person we can think of.
Who's
they're
the famous
all
singer
coming.
That went crazy for a while? Sinead O'Connor. Yeah.
Sinead.
Or Hozier is also Irish.
Oh, wow.
I'd invite
See?
Him, too.
Or
okay.
we can invite one of my favorite golfers, Rory McIlroy.
They're all coming.
Rory.
Northern Ireland.
Oh, Rory. Okay. Well, we've got a lot of Irish celebrities that are coming over, which is perfect because we're going to make an Irish-themed feast. Who would like to take on the I don't even know that we should call it a cocktail because I have a feeling.
Well, we're going to call it a cocktail. We're going to call it border wall cocktail because if Brexit goes through,
oh boy,
there will be a new entry and exit points between North and South Ireland again, which is so sad in my mind.
That is fair. This whole thing. This
yeah,
whole
you have to show your passport to get through. So I'm not for that. I'm for peace and humanity.
Me too. So what do you think you're going to make?
I'm going to make the border wall and tear it down, is what I say.
Uh-huh.
Tear down the border wall.
You're going to drink it away.
I'm going to drink it away. And that's going to be, you know, an Irish coffee is, we can start with it. I'm okay starting with it.
Okay, sure.
So it's just black coffee with a shot of Jameson or Bushmill or I like
Your
the Jameson
favorite.
Redbreast or
yeah.
you know, things like that.
Favorite Irish whiskey?
Yeah. And typically, it's you just take cream, and you don't want to whip it. You want to shake it. Put it into a shaker with a lid, a little bit of sugar in it, and then shake it because you want it to be thickened but not whipped. And then you're going to put it on the back of a spoon and pour it so it lays over the top. And what you end up with is a separate cream from the black coffee base.
Yeah. It looks
right?
like a Guinness.
And you know what we're going to do? We're going to tear that down. We're going to stir our Irish coffee up and tear down the wall.
Wow.
Yeah. So
level.
There you go, Chef. Now it's up to you.
Damn, you just rocked the house with that.
Yeah.
I didn't want to stick to a cabbage soup.
What's your cabbage soup consistent?
I'm going to do a cabbage soup with sausage, pork sausage. and bacon, both of them. Mm. So rendered the bacon, add the onions, caramelize the onions. Sarah will be with us, so she knows how to do that now. She can caramelize the onions. And then put all your cabbage julienne in there, sweat the whole thing up, put some chicken stock and or beef stock or whatever you can have on hand, preferably not water. Maybe a little white wine as well, and then reduce the whole thing down by cooking it. As soon as everything is tender, just stop the soup and then put the diced sausage in there, just as is. A cooked sausage, obviously, not raw. And then put it in there and then serve it as is.
I made this almost exact same soup the other night.
You're Irish. I did not know that.
Well, my husband is Irish, and we talk about how cabbage is the one factor that really crosses over from the Japanese to the Irish. They have a deep love of the cabbages. Mm.
Tom, like the Okinawa pancake.
Like the Okinawa pancake. That's right. Okonomiyaki. It's full of cabbage. Yeah, I love cabbage. That. Yeah.
For dinner, we're going to go traditional boiled Irish or English dinner. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's not so much boiled, though.
It's
baker.
It's not. I was going to say, yours is not, which is what makes it delicious.
And here's the thing I'll say about it is that, to me, buying a little slice of brisket in the store, like, it's just sad. You know, it's just, you see a little, it's like a little wrap. It's all plastic wrap. It's kind of sad. And so I like to go to Market House Corned Beef on Olive, mm-hmm. and I buy the whole brisket, even if I don't need it.
That's the way it's got to go,
right?
Man.
It's about 14 pounds, and it fits beautifully in a roaster. Same pan you would use for your whole turkey. Mm-hmm. And then I fill it halfway up with water around the brisket, put all those cool spices that come with it on top.
Yeah, don't get rid of those.
And then I cover it and bake it for at least a couple of hours.
At what temperature?
At 325, 350. Mm-hmm. And then I pull the cover off, and then I continue to bake it for another couple hours. And so I get a nice little crust on the top. My spices brown up, the mustard
seeds. That's what I loved so much about your recipe is that brown Maillard reaction that happens with that braising with the top off, and it gets a little crispy. Mm-hmm.
I like
so
that.
Good.
But when you buy the whole brisket, you do get the fat between the nose and the flat of the brisket, right? You'll see a brisket, it's kind of long, flat, and then it's got a little knob on the top of it. Mm-hmm. And that's called the nose of the brisket. And there's a thick layer of fat in between there. But you just, when it's done, you just cut it out. And it's not a big deal.
It's what it is.
And then those braising liquids, just taste them. Put a spoon in, taste it, make sure it's not too salty. Those braising liquids are what, as my corned beef is resting on the counter, I put my whole carrots, my whole small Yukon potatoes, my whole wedges of cabbage, maybe celery if you want. You don't need to. And I braise those in that braising liquid if it's not too salty. If it is too salty, I pour half out and replace it with fresh water. Mm-hmm. And then I braise those vegetables. Then I pull everything out onto a big platter, slice my brisket, lay all my vegetables out, and then I take a cup of that braising liquid and I add one stick of butter to it.
Because you care.
Let's say we're talking for six people.
Yeah.
One stick of butter to one cup of liquid, and I melt those together and pour that over top of my whole boiled dinner, right? It's a little bit like pot-au-feu, right?
Yeah, it's a little bit like pot-au-feu, and then serve some cornichons and some sea salt on the side, and I'm coming over.
Yeah, it's just very simple. Yeah, serve some mustard or... my mother would serve mint jelly, which I don't. Oh, I don't like.
You're not living that life.
Oh, you just killed that dish.
No, that's not true. She would serve that with her roast lamb. I'm sorry, I mistook that. Okay, you're on dessert, chef.
Oof.
Don't this forget is bonus very, coming. You got to be active.
Yeah, this is a very heavy, nice, light dinner, I guess. The cabbage soup and cabbage and briskets. That's nice. So for dessert, I think I'm just going to make a. Let me see.
Horseradish flan. I heard they're delicious.
Yeah. That's for last week. Something probably just cheese. Just some good...
Oh, nice light dessert.
Some good cheese for
dessert.
Yeah, after
a big boil of things. And a big, just some cheese.
I just don't get the whole cheese thing that way.
Why?
Well, because it's 100% fat.
I know, but it's good fat as opposed to bad fat.
Okay.
You know, it's fat. Fat you can digest. All you have to do is move around the table a little bit.
Okay.
But I think a nice tray of beautiful cheese, blue Stilton. I love Stilton. Good, fresh Stilton.
What about some Irish cheddar?
And some, I was going to say, some beautiful old cheddar and some good sheep cheese, because they have good sheep cheese too. Ooh. So you just make a nice trio of cheeses, maybe some dried fruits, mm-hmm. Make a nice little compote, dried raisin, dried apricot, dried plum. Do a nice little compote of that with caramelized onion if you have some left.
Yeah.
Cold, you've mixed
nice,
the whole thing
nice
together.
Nice light dessert, yes, chef.
Irish soda bread, nice dense bread in there too already.
Nah, we'd probably not do that.
Okay. All right. That was a fine dinner, Katie. I'm glad Terry and I got to cook.
Yes, I am too.
We're looking at cooking with some kids this summer here at the Hot Stove Society, and Chef Bridget Charters is going to come on and tell us all about what she has planned for those little rascals on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show from the Hot Stove Society. Thanks for joining us. We're here every Saturday and Sunday, oftentimes three times a week. You know, I heard last week the last hour of the show at 5 o'clock on Sunday night. It's kind of cool.
Oh, ooh, nice.
But certainly Saturdays from 4 until 6 and Sunday mornings 10 until 12. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O.
And Chef Bridget Charters here. She's an instructor here at the Hot Stove Society and has put together a week of fun for a kids camp here this coming summer. After last year, Bridget, I can't believe you're sitting in front of me right now.
You know, it's really, I won't say difficult, but it's...
challenging.
It's challenging, yes.
But rewarding in its own challenge.
Well, it's important. There's an entire generation, I feel like, that doesn't cook.
Mm-hmm.
And we're coming up, they're in their 20s and 30s. They just, you know...
It's okay. They're all coming to Hot Stove to learn how to cook now.
Well, not really. Not really. Though those 20 to 30-year-olds, we're not going to see them till they're 40, I think. Mm-hmm. So there's this generation that's just, they're not cooking because their parents didn't really cook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you and I, we were all raised with our parents like, hey, make your lunch and cook your dinner.
My mother never said that to me.
She didn't?
No.
She made your lunches.
And she made our dinners.
But she did teach you.
But she was a stay-at-home mom, too.
That was her job. Right. But
my mom was, too. She never made our
but
lunches.
But she was, you know, cooking for you, not simply giving you the $5 or the $2 and sending you off to school.
Correct.
Which is a little bit different when you have a two-income household where both parents are working, and so that you may see that more frequently, and maybe that's the generation you're speaking of, is these kids that grew up in that.
Actually, even this generation. Now, I was talking to a buddy at the golf club the other day, and he says that he was getting ready to go home, and he was taking home from the club like a to-go dinner. But he said, "I said, what are the kids having?" He says, "Oh no, this one ordered from this company. Ordered pizza. The boy ordered from the chicken strip place, and his wife had already ordered dinner from a salad place, and he was bringing home a steak from the club."
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
That's not that unusual anymore. Okay, let's go back to why we're changing that here at the Hot Stove.
You know, yes, it is challenging to teach kids, and it is a different metrics in terms of teaching children versus teaching adults.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so important, and so we keep doing them. We keep coming back.
So what's the age group? Same age as your kid, right?
Yeah, he's going to be 14 this year. So, yes, it is that. The hope is the range is that kind of 11 to 13.
Mm-hmm.
When you get them when they're 8 and 9, they have a ball, but and maybe they absorb, maybe they don't.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of tricky. We had some kids last year that were 14 that were like ho-hum, you know. So we had to kind of divide up the tables, which actually worked out well. And we gave them more complex things to do and, like, taught them how to sauté. And so we had to divide things up. But
you should do two. You should do one for that 8 to 10-year-old set and one for the 11
Yeah, because it's not painful enough to do one. You should do two.
Yeah. You should do one for the 11 to 14 set.
Well, we do. We have the Girl Scouts. A friend of mine is a Girl Scout leader, and we have been doing the Girl Scouts from, I believe they're Ballard High and Holy Names. It's a group of gals, and this is their last year. They're all graduating.
Aww.
And so we've had them every year. They're going to be coming in April again, and we do a day, actually. And then what's the school in Bellevue? We got connected with
The International School.
International School, and they come for a three-day. So as you get those kids that are older, then it really soaks in because they have to support themselves. But when you have those younger ones, that's them cooking their lunch and cooking their dinner.
Yeah.
You know.
What's your curriculum?
So we're going to be doing pasta. from scratch. So my goal is that, like, look, no, we're not doing it for you. Here, there's the flour, there the eggs, mm-hmm. go. Mm-hmm. And so the hope is that they do it by hand, all of it. So the first day's pasta and kind of all the fixings. They're going to make their own sauces. They're going to get the pans. They're going to put everything together.
And that's pretty next level because a lot of adults don't know how to make pasta right. from scratch. So that's right. really teaching yeah. a certain skill.
So it's great. And then the next day we're doing sushi. The day after that, one of our most popular classes here is dumplings. And so we're doing dumplings mm-hmm. with them. They're going to make their own dough. They're going to make their filling.
Have you seen the movie Crazy Rich Asians yet?
Oh, my God, yes.
The dumpling scene?
Awesome.
Awesome. Don't you just want to be at that table?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure my mom would love to have you over folding wontons sometime.
I would love
yeah,
to do
have
that.
Us over. Yeah, have us
just anytime.
The more the merrier with that project, frankly, because it can take you a long time if you've only got a couple people at the table.
Yeah, that or making spring rolls together, mm-hmm. you know, something in that vein.
Raviolis.
Raviolis, yeah.
It's, anything it's awesome. That takes a long time, you invite people over. It's called free right. labor.
Yeah, and it was, you know, the last one's baking and pastry. So every day the kids bring food home for dinner mm-hmm. every day. So they're going to bring home cut pasta the first day. They're going to bring home sushi that they made the second day. They're going to bring home dumplings for dinner the third day. They're going to bring home kind of components for tacos the fourth day and desserts the last day.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. I guess, you know, you could look at this as we're just promoting this class, or you could look at it and think about how, if you're not coming to this class, how to engage your children in the kitchen, in the process, in the setting expectations, right?
Right.
Letting it go a little bit, like, okay, it's okay if they use a knife. Just it's train scary. Them how to do right. it right. properly, right? And then cooking those dumplings, maybe introducing some little bit of hot sauce here or there. Those are parental tasks, I think.
Right.
I said recently at an event, I think it was the opera that I was in with Matteo Messina, where that if as a parent, you know, these kids don't have these skills when they leave, not necessarily dumplings, but certainly roasting a chicken or right. making an omelet or right. some basic life skills, then you have failed miserably.
Yeah.
Yeah. You need this part of the responsibility.
You know, we did caramelized onion on the show earlier. It's one thing both of my boys learned at a very young age how to make caramelized onion.
That's
just
awesome.
Very simple because you know how many times I call them and they go, oh, yeah, I'm just caramelizing some onions. I'm going to make some pasta. I'm like, let's make pasta look really good, right?
Yeah.
They don't make pasta. They didn't make the pasta from scratch. But it's just another way to teach them simple things, especially if they're going to school or, you know, they don't have much money to spend. It's a great
it's
way
perfect.
To
think. Well, and crepe yeah. you know. Oh, yeah. Spencer loves to make those,
yeah.
you know.
Mm-hmm. They're fun.
I wonder if yeah. there couldn't be a class series for parents that want to actually engage with their kids more in the kitchen, but maybe are a little bit like, I don't know how to get them in the kitchen. I don't know when is the right time to teach them knife skills. I think that's part of maybe why it's not getting passed down as well as understanding how to incorporate your kids and letting go of some control. I know Brittany Bartleben, who's often here, our pastry chef extraordinaire, was talking about, like, you just got to be okay that the kitchen's going to get a little dirty, you know, when you're dealing with flour and sugar and letting go of that control.
If you don't want
bit.
Your kitchen to get dirty, then you know where you're standing.
Right.
Well, it's not the same people that don't want their kitchen to smell like fish. They don't want to cook fish in it because it makes my kitchen smell like fish.
Well, it's that exploration. So we're talking about parents that don't do a lot of cooking. Just pick a good book. We talked about, you know, reviewing some books on the show, and we can start doing that. But like those Cook's Illustrated books have the step-by-step photos. Back when I was coming up, I used the Jacques Pepin Le Technique, and I would just go. Yeah, it was awesome. Mm-hmm. And I'd go through those photos and like, okay, mom, will you buy me whatever? And figure it out. Like,
I would tell you, if you're going to buy that book of signed first edition, it's about $1,200 a copy right now.
I know.
Do you have one?
I do. I
have one. Yeah, that's what I thought. You can buy it from Tom for $1,200.
No, I've got one. I can, if you need it signed, I can take it to Aspen.
Katie, when you have kids, you want to have kids.
Yeah, I
when
do.
You have kids, do you feel like it's important to first teach a knife skill or to first start on maybe your heritage, like making a dumpling?
I think it would be the traditional foods that, like, I grew up eating. Like, I have a very clear memory of my mom making, you know, Japanese New Year's food and kind of letting me taste things along the way before I was really of age to really get involved in a major way. It was like, taste this. And then she would say, oh, it needs a little bit of sugar or it needs a little bit more ginger. And I think that was a way to get me involved and my palate involved and interested because she was doing it in this very loving, I'm participating, but not necessarily getting my hands in there quite
and
yet.
And this is a very, very good foundation to taste your food as you make it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a foundation.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, to understand that because it sticks with you forever.
It really does. I mean, I again, have it seared in my memory being on linoleum tile floor in our old house and tasting this or that.
All right.
That's great. That's great.
Bridget, tell us the dates of the class.
The dates, it's July 22nd through the 26th. And we've got some spots open. It's starting to fill.
9 a.m. to 2 p.m. every day.
Right. And they come in, we'll have a little breakfast for them. So you can literally, Nina will be out front. You can drop them in the load zone. Mm-hmm. Just open the door, slow down to about 5 miles an hour.
You're going
to
get the phone ringing.
Sorry. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. But literally, you can pull up to the load zone. Nina will be out there in an apron. She'll receive the kids and they come up. We'll have some cartoons going in the lobby here. They can hang out and then they'll come in. We'll have some scones or things to munch on in the morning and they go right into production.
I was going to say, I would have loved this as a kid. Yeah.
Okay. It's great.
Bridget, are you going to stay with us for the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge?
Can I?
Yes. I'm a little rusty. That's good. I like that.
Okay.
All right. It's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia here from the Hot Stove Society. We are going to be joined by Chef and the Chapeau. Katie O is going to be our announcer today.
Mm-hmm, your quiz master.
Chef Bridget Charters is going to be here. I almost called you Bartleben, which was going to be a problem. But Chef Bridget Charters is here and me.
Each of you are going to receive 5 questions in this quiz. Whoever gets the most correct wins, and the least amount of correct answers is the big, fat loser. Tom's putting the loser sign up on his forehead, taunting the both of you. Bridget is a very competitive guest, so we're always happy to have her. And as we like to do, today we are playing for Tim and our audience. His birthday is this week, and I don't even know. Tim, do you know the show well enough to know that you're going to get something really rad? Okay, yeah. He just says yes.
He knows that much,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay, great. So, Thierry, should you lose today, what are you going
to
give away?
Well, have you been to Luke yet?
Luke.
All right, so we're going to send you to Luke. I'm sending you to Luke if I lose. Brunch for two.
Brunch for
Saturday
two.
Saturday or Sunday at Luke.
Very nice. Bridget, what will you give away should you lose?
You know, I'm going to give away 2 tickets to Taste Washington for the Grand Tasting.
Yeah, General Admission Grand Tasting.
On Sunday, the 31st of March.
Tom, what will you give away to Tim if you lose?
So I'm going to give away a seat to my Timpano class on May 3rd. It's $150 or $60 value. $165.
So much pasta.
Comes with dinner and a beautiful selection of Italian wines from my cellar.
Ooh.
Oh, nice.
Everyone loves taking a dip in Tom's cellar.
You want Tom to lose today.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's for one, and it's May 3rd. It's a drop-dead date. There's no going around it unless I drop dead.
Wow.
Tom,
don't jinx yourself.
We'll have a much bigger party.
If I drop dead, I'm worth more dead than alive. Number one.
Life insurance policy.
And number two is I've had a good life.
Yeah, and Tom,
I've been able to spend time with my buddies here.
That's usually what we say about, like,
nice
pasture raised beef and things like that.
And I just want to remember that I have to cook my wake before I die. So if you could tell me when I'm going to drop dead, would be good. So I can plan the week before to have
place the older ring, do the prep.
All right, moving away from this death talk.
Morbid
death talk on a food show. Mm-hmm. Thierry, you like to go first. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay, your first question. How many standard wine bottles make up a Jeroboam?
So Magnum is 2. Jeroboam is 4 bottles.
4 bottles is correct. Very nice. Your second question. We commonly refer to the 2 parts of an egg as the yolk and the white. What is the proper term for the white? what's its scientific name?
Tom, why are you laughing?
I got it in my head. I don't think I could pronounce
it. Is it
you
albumine?
Can't pronounce it?
Is it? No, it's not albumin.
What did you say?
Albumin.
That sounds like the French version, so I'll take it. It's albumin.
Oh.
Yeah. You got it. Yeah, you got it.
Read the subtitle.
Yeah, exactly. Your third question. What type of fish is used in the making of Worcestershire sauce?
Anchovies.
Anchovies is correct. Very nice. Thierry, halloumi is a type of cheese originating from which island? I'll give you some options. Cyprus, Mykonos, or Corfu?
I'm
a lot of islands, a lot of Greek islands.
I'm going to go with Corfu.
It's actually Cyprus.
Oh.
Your final question, Thierry. Which Scottish dessert consists of whipped cream, whiskey, honey, raspberries, and oatmeal? Is it oat cakes? Is it clouty? Or is it cranican, I believe is how that's pronounced?
I have no idea. So I'm going to go with the last one, cricken.
Cranican?
Wait, whatever you
did
say.
Did I even pronounce that right?
Heineken.
Heineken. Heineken is not an
two,
option.
Please.
But your one guess is correct.
It's
the thing that I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing correctly.
Wow.
So very
Cranican.
Nice. Thierry, 4 out of 5 today.
That's good. Wow. Storming.
Oh. Wait. There is 5 out of 5, too. That does exist.
It was a polite clap from the audience.
Especially from...
Golf clap.
All right, Bridget.
Okay.
All right, Bridget, your first question. From what plant does the grenadilla fruit come from? Is it the anthurium? Is it the passion flower? Or is it bromeliads?
I'm going to say A.
The anthurium?
Yeah.
That is incorrect. It's actually the passion flower. Bridget, your second question. What gives peppers their heat?
It's the ripeness of the pepper that gives it the heat. The seeds and the ribs.
That's true, but is there a chemical compound?
The capsicum?
Yes, there you go. That's the right answer. I kind of led you to that one, but I felt like you knew it. So
you know that.
It's all good. Your third question, Lola Rosa is what?
Lola Rosa is a lettuce.
That is correct. Very nice. Your next question, about when did concentrated orange juice become commercially available? Was that in 1939, 1945, or 1950?
Commercially available.
Yes.
I want to say the 50s.
It's actually 1945. In 1944, scientists found a way to concentrate the juice in a vacuum and then freeze it without destroying the flavor or vitamin content. Who knew? All right, your final question. What is the world's largest producer of grapefruit? Is it the U.S., Israel, or Cuba?
The U.S.
The U.S. is correct. Very nice.
Texas.
Wow.
Yeah. Texas.
Israel is not a very large country. That would be hard hard to do.
Unless it's just all
Cuba.
Grapefruit.
I think of blood oranges coming from Israel in a big way.
Oh, right. Really? Yeah. Okay. 3 out of 5. Not bad. Didn't
not
beat
bad.
Terry. So it's really going to come... down to Tom. Tom's performance today. You ready?
Deep breath.
Let me stretch a little bit first.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Tom, your first question. In which U.S. state are grapefruits, we're going back to the grapefruit, not grown commercially? Is it Minnesota, Washington, or Alaska?
They have grapefruit in those three states?
Exactly.
Wow.
Well, one of them they don't.
Wait
that's the point.
One of them?
Commercially. In other words, they could be in... orangery kind of hothouses.
Yeah. But those could be anywhere.
This is diabolical.
Yeah.
It is diabolical.
I'd say they're not grown in Washington commercially.
Well, get to know your state because they are. Mm. It's Alaska. It's Alaska where they are not grown.
Wow.
I would like to see a picture from your computer of a grapefruit farm.
Okay, Tom, your next question. To what country is the mung bean native? Is it Mongolia, India, or Pakistan?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, he says.
Native?
That's right.
Mongolia. India.
That second guess was the right one. But
isn't it where Mongolia is?
But your first guess, unfortunately, I feel like you had confidence until Bridget shook her head.
It makes me feel good.
What country does the word mocha come from? Is it from Yemen, Morocco, or Algeria? Dang.
Wow.
Morocco.
I was going to say Starbucks.
That's incorrect.
Algeria.
It's from Yemen. Yemen is where that comes
really?
From.
What?
Mocha, a port in Yemen, lends its name
it's
to
It's yummy,
certain...
so I should have known. It was from Yemen.
Oh,
my
that's
God.
That's a cute Funny so play cute. On words mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. Tom, you want to keep going?
Yes.
Let's finish this up. What is India's national fruit? Is it the lychee,
grapefruit.
Mango, or... Incorrect. Okay. Incorrect.
Is it lychee, mango, or what?
Or chiku.
Chiku.
It's actually the mango.
Yeah.
Who's that?
Just what I thought.
That's India's national oh. fruit. And your last question, Tom. If you ordered Kartoffel Salat...
Can I my order German a new is, question maker?
My German is not so good. In a German restaurant, what would you be served?
Pancakes, veal and potatoes.
Here's your choices. Pancakes, fried ham, or potato salad?
Potato salad.
Yes,
you got
here
it.
You go.
Salat.
We got it's you on the board. One out of five. Tom, that makes you the
loser.
But that makes Tim a very big winner.
Tim, I hope you have fun.
And
hope you're
Timpano
available
class.
On May 3rd to come to our Timpano class. If you want to be part of our show like Tim, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. This show is produced by Large Media. That's L-A-R-J Media. Our lead producer being Sarah Leibovitz. Our sound engineer is Sean. Don't call me Del Torre. If you want to become part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $15. It comes with a breakfast sandwich and a hot cup of coffee.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.